Hi everyone, I'm Michael Whistler, and I sincerely believe that science fiction can help us save the world. Even if that world might turn into a desert post-apocalyptic landscape because of climate change, well, at least there'll still be circuses in that environment. So that's what we're going to explore today. This is Exploring Tomorrow. So joining me today is Ben Marshall, writes under BP Marshall. Just for a background for the folks listening, Ben, you've been watching my podcast on YouTube and commenting, and that's how we connected. And we have definitely some similar ideas as we were talking just before getting into the podcast. We're kind of on similar wavelengths, so there's some cool crossover there. And because of that, I got interested in your work, asked for a copy of your novel, The Last Circus on Earth, for Christmas, and got it, read it, and loved it. And then I was like, well, we got to talk, I got to ask you to come on to the show and chat with you. So, I mean, that's a little bit of my background, but I'd love to open it up for you to tell me a little bit about yourself, how you got into writing science fiction.
My origin as a writer is unusual. I was a critical care and remote area nurse. And a friend of mine was setting up a television program and asked me to come in and consult for it. And I ended up becoming a storyliner. That's in the writer's room, creating stories, and also a script writer. During the process of which, it trained my brain to constantly generate stories to the point at which I was literally in my dreams inserting commercial breaks and looking for cliffhangers at certain points in my dreams. That's the intense world of television for you. Then I've basically continued script writing, and I still am today. And at a certain point, I had a very silly idea, which was, hey, wouldn't it be fun to write a book like so many idiots do? And I am that idiot, and I wrote a book. and it was so much fun. I had one rule for it. Everything had to keep getting worse until the very end. And it just happened to be a science fiction book. And I did what every first writer does, throws all your ideas into the one pot, mix them up, and have fun. That's a little bit about my background. I'm still writing now. I'm writing speculative fiction. I'm writing historical novels. I've just done a play with a colleague, which is going to be on in a couple of nights down in Hobart, about 5 hours from here. So that's me.
That's amazing. That's awesome. And so, like, what was the impetus there to your friend asking you to come help him with TV? Like, did you have any experience background before that in storytelling?
No, not at all. An avid reader, someone with a curious mind in all senses of the word. I was always interested in science after I left school, that is. School killed any interest in the world. But a few years later, I got past that and I discovered science books for lay readers like myself. I just followed on from there. My interest in science developed along with my literary taste for speculative fiction.
That's beautiful. That's great. You made that leap into writing a book, and I assume the book you're talking about is Last Circus on Earth, or did you write something before that?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've that is manuscript number six.
Nice.
I think.
Okay.
So it won the 2019 Fantastic Prize,
right,
which was New Zealand and Australia.
Got that on the cover.
yeah,
that's awesome.
And that also got me a publishing deal with a tiny, wonderful little publishing house called Brio in Sydney. And of course, you know, bang, then the pandemic hits. So any thought of marketing, festivals, that kind of stuff just went out the window. And yeah,
I feel that. I was actually, because I came from this background of doing film and everything, and then only in the last few years have gotten, you know, real serious about, kind of shifted into the world of, like, my day job's in documentary filmmaking, and then like my night aspirations are writing science fiction. So only like more recently have I gotten into this mentality of, okay, I really want to make a go of the writing thing in many fronts, and so I need to start attending conferences and festivals and things like that. And so I had like signed up for my first one, and it was going to happen in April last year, and sure enough, you know, COVID hit, shut everything down. But thankfully, there's a few, like, I've just came off of this weekend attending Flights of Foundry, all online.
Yeah.
And that was just a fantastic experience there. Got to connect with a lot of other folks there as well. And actually going to be having several folks from that I met through that come on to the podcast and chat with them.
Cool.
So hopefully there'll be some cross-pollinating there too, and introduce some of those folks to your work through this as well. So, man,
that would be great. Thank you.
Absolutely. Mm. So this book that we're about to get into talking about is the sixth manuscript, and that's remarkable. Just because you were saying like how you threw everything in the pot for that first one and stirred it up, and that you everything had to keep getting worse. And I'm like, and I thought you were describing The Last Circus on Earth. Just, you know, from that, it seems like there's a lot going on, and you know, there is this escalating nature to the story. But one of the things that I wanted to mention about it is, and I was going to ask you specifically if this was an influence in reading The Last Circus on Earth. What stood out to me was the similarity in vibe, and just kind of the milieu, in a way, of Ray Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes. And I didn't know if that was like intentional. I love that book, you know, and so that immediately pulled me into this. Oh, sure.
The working title of The Last Circus on Earth was The Pricking of Thumbs, as a heartfelt tribute to Ray Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Beautiful. That's awesome. That's awesome. That's amazing. Yeah, because I felt this like kindred sort of spirit there, but still with its own clear personality. And, you know, just paying it maybe a little bit of homage to it in its sort of style and voice, but still very distinct. And I got to tell you, I got pulled into the book and really just enjoyed the journey that Blanco is on. So for our listeners, I want to tell us a little bit about The Last Circus on Earth, what it's about, and maybe a little bit about what inspired you to write it.
Well, I'll just mention what inspired me to write it first off,
sure,
if that's okay.
Absolutely.
The manuscript that I wrote immediately before it was a historical novel, a pirate novel, if you will, set in the Atlantic in the mid-1700s. Mm. And the idea was for that book is I wanted to go back in time. I wanted to go back in time to the what we call the beginnings of the Age of Enlightenment. I wanted to go back to that world. I wanted to have a grand adventure with an amazing crew of diverse and wild characters, and get into all sorts of trouble and learn about the idea that humanity is on some kind of, some kind of progress. You know, like the Darwinian ape and then the civilized man standing there with the spear.
Right. Classic image. You know,
I wanted to go to that era and discover whether there was a genuine progress to humanity that was taking us from one place that wasn't quite as good to another place that was a little better. So I visited that world, the early Age of Enlightenment, and my lead character is a nerd, but he's also a reluctant captain of a pirate ship. And so when I left the world of King Charles and the Second and the Royal Society in London and farewelled my scurvy crew, I next wanted to go to the future and basically see how it turns out. And I chose the near future, 2070. And I thought, look, we've got so many crises reaching critical mass at the moment, extinction crisis, global warming, etc., rising autocracy and totalitarianism, those things. I wanted to go to the near future, 50 years in the future, and find hope. And so the book starts with a character who is a person of unusual appearance, in a circus of freaks and other people. They're just people of unusual appearance. They don't have any magical or sci-fi powers or anything like that. They're just ordinary people, and they're trapped in what is essentially a traveling militia. The circus is not, as you know, what it seems. And so they travel through the landscape, much like land pirates. But there is a deeper agenda. But Blanca, the hero, starts off the story in a very poor state. He is essentially a child soldier. He was bought as a child and has been trained in a most brutal way by the circus owners. And he's a very unhappy young man, and he wants out. And he is very close to self-harming. And the only thing that's stopping him is the fact that not all of the people in this circus are evil or bad. They are just people, and they have formed a family of sorts. Right. That and the fact that he rescues a dog and falls in love, and yep. There's a few things.
Yeah.
But that keeps him chained to a group of people who are very diverse, and whose diversity is the key to his eventual success, I suppose you would call it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to see, underlying the premise of an adventure story, I wanted to see if I could speculate plausibly about having unlimited resources to save human civilization, or create a new type of Homo sapien, a new type of Homo human, who could sustainably survive into the distant future. Right. Why is humanity reaching a crunch point now, which we may not emerge with our civilization intact? What is stopping us from getting past that? And could I think of any way plausible using, you know, some reasonable sci-fi spec fic ideas that are on the table now.
Right. Absolutely.
To find a way past this troubling bottleneck. And so that's what the book was about.
It's an interesting way of to approach it from a different lens. It's like, it's an interesting way to address this question of like, how might we make it past the great filter, as some astrophysicists call it, you know, like maybe our civilization, there's this maybe great filter in all the universe, right? That civilizations potentially are out there and they mature, they reach roughly the point we're at, but then because of rapid technological advancement, polluting, nuclear warfare, all these kinds of things, they end up kind of hitting this point where they self-destruct. And if you know, it's kind of hitting a filter, and very few civilizations potentially make it through. So it's an interesting speculation to think, like, to not even take it in that realm, but to stay on Earth and think, okay, well, how do we make it past that great filter here on Earth, potentially? It's really a compelling, fascinating read. And it takes a while to kind of get into what I would say is sort of the more science sci-fi elements. But I felt that was a really strong choice, a very like beautifully deliberate choice to kind of delay some of those elements and just let it be this weird future that feels like the past in a lot of ways. Having come off of writing something that was historical fiction, were you wanting to really frame this as like we kind of like went backwards for a while certain aspects still seem to progress forward?
I mean, I was looking for hope, and as you know, with these books, I mean, like your Sleepwalker, you do an incredible amount of research, and the reason that there's a lot of spec fic writers who also write historical novels is because we're research junkies.
Right.
And the research required for The Last Circus on Earth was immense. So looking for hope, going into the frontiers of science, and it is a joy in itself. But I went in with a certain amount of pessimism, because from my historical research and my research into the nature of human biology and human consciousness indicates that we are at a time now where we have reached our biological limits to continue sustainably. And grow in a nurturing way into new forms. I think when we talk about complex issues, I always come back to what's the biology? What are we talking about here? We're talking about a human being. Okay, that's an animal. That's a social animal. What are their behaviors? What do they do in these situations? What's unusual about them compared to other animals? Etc. And the fascinating thing about humans is that the most complex object in the known universe is between our ears.
Right.
We simply, all of the sciences that we've got, we simply do not know of a more complex object than what's in here. That's not saying we're better than a cow or a slime mold. That's not a value judgment.
Right.
That's just pointing out what we actually know about us. So that makes us interesting, not just from an anthropomorphic point of view, but, you know, if an alien creature made out of something completely different came in, they would probably find us pretty interesting too.
Yeah.
So I wanted to find whether our biological limitations were a ring fence that we could not get past. And that's one of the ideas I explore in The Last Circus. And as you know, I go past biological limitations
right.
to try something else. What my research indicates is that we have essentially reached a kind of biological limitation in what we can decide collectively on the global scale to do. While we can do any number of really wonderful things individually, in small groups, in families, in communities, in nations, and globally, we're at a point where globally our governments are corrupted by self-interest and are not pursuing the collective interests of the nation states and also the globe itself. So I was looking to see if there was a way for human animals to get past that, or if we could build a new one, a new one that was still recognizably us, still an emotional, rational, social creature who loves communion, who loves to delight in nature and family and people and animals and all of those good things. And so I speculated about if you had almost unlimited resources. I'm talking $1 trillion of the biggest nation state of the world rising, and you threw everything at creating the possibility of a new human that could get past the bottleneck and move smoothly and sustainably in a nurturing way into the future, into the kind of lovely, fluffy science fiction future where we like to imagine, yes, one day we will go to the stars and meet other creatures from around the universe, you know, all those kind of things, and peaceful reign and, yeah, all good things. So, but of course, I won't give too many spoilers away, but some of those experiments may or may not have worked.
Right.
But it's such an interesting area to look at, both what is the human default, what is our high tide mark up here, what can we do and what can't we do, and why. Also, one of the critical questions was, and I think I try to answer that, is why it is that globally and collectively we are currently completely unable to do what is obviously necessary right. in saving our species and the planet along with it. So those are just some of the issues that are the matrix in which my little adventure sits.
You know, little adventure. It's definitely quite. It's got quite the scope. How many thousands of miles did they end up traveling in this troop of circus folk?
Something. Yeah, it goes from London to a place in Central Asia. Currently, either called West Turkestan or Xinjiang province, depending on which side of the political spectrum you fall. I have been there. I've done some mountaineering in that region. It's very remote, I like a road trip. What can I say?
Yeah, and it's quite the road trip with some. Some moments of almost Mad Max-esque strange contraptions. I love the flying machine that Blanco's got to reluctantly strap himself into, and different things like that he gets himself into. But also Blanco seems to, you know, he has a really just compelling journey as a character, which I think is utterly crucial for this kind of storytelling. Because, you know, there can be all these ideas and all this speculation about the things that we're talking about, which is great. But at the end of the day, what keeps us glued as readers to these stories is because we begin to connect with the character. And I felt that very quickly with Blanco. I mean, it's, you know, you for me at least, you did the surefire way, you know, save a dog as a dog lover, and your character's got my heart like for life. but he goes beyond that. He's, you know, he's kind of a reluctant leader, reluctant hero, in a lot of ways. But it's fascinating to see his growth and development. How much of that character and that kind of trajectory for Blanco did you have in mind going into all these speculations, and how much did you have to kind of go back and be like, wait, I got to like have an actual central journey for my character?
Blanco emerged from the character of a child soldier, an African child soldier. Trapped, trained, not a good person. What he does is not good.
Right.
But his heart wants more. His heart wants better. And in those small opportunities where he can be kind, he will be kind. He's not smarter than anybody else. He doesn't have any powers. He's just trained to endure his hellish life, and simply caring was enough to put him in a situation and wave him off and just write down whatever he did next. In many ways, my characters emerge from the side, and they wander into the background, and they come a bit closer, and they become inextricably linked. And at that stage, you know, there's no, it's like herding cats. They're going to do what they do. So you're just writing down what they're doing as the situation, which is completely untenable, unfolds, gets worse again, and the people in it try to find some resolution for themselves and for those they love. I like that characters lean on other people for their help to augment their fears and their thinking, and to provide them with what they need, and together move ahead. So yeah, Blanco just took over, as did Sparrow, as did Tog and Baba Yaga and all the rest of them. Strombo, the gaffer. Mm-hmm. I've met a lot of people in my life, and some of them are in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like, especially someone like the gaffer, like, it feels like, oh, yeah, I've run into these people, you know.
Yeah.
I could imagine that. And that's a great place to write from as well, kind of pulling from life experience. That's really awesome, though, to be able to imagine those characters coming in like that, and just because they are set up in such – I mean, anyone in this existence, the being in this traveling militia – circus, would really, they have to be made of some tough stuff and be have a level of resilience. So it makes sense that just already imagining, well, who's the kind of person that's part of this? Well, they're going to have a lot to say about where that's going to go. So that's great. And I love that you've touched on this idea of optimism and the importance of that optimism was to you in writing this book, even though, you begin with essentially a child soldier character. So that's a really dark place to be. And a future that's not necessarily particularly bright. We get these, what I enjoy about it is it's not completely desolate, like a total Mad Max type of futuristic world. There are towns and villages and cities. They operate in many ways very differently than maybe we're used to right now. And yet there's clearly a market for a traveling circus to come into town, do some entertaining, maybe, get a little something on the side, a little less legally. And but how much did you feel like you needed to balance this seemingly sort of bleak view of the future and the optimism that you're trying to bring into it? Or did that feel like it just came very naturally?
It comes very naturally. I spent quite a few decades traveling and living in other places, and I've been and lived in circumstances that are probably unusual, so the various differences you see from town to village to city in The Last Circus on Earth are absolutely natural, and they're places that I've been to a sense. So that sense of world building for me was just writing what I've experienced directly in that way.
Makes sense. Yeah, because it feels very authentic, even as it feels a little, it's strange and different in some ways. It's certainly the way law enforcement works in these worlds. But yeah, go ahead.
The other thing I'd say is that when you are looking for hope, traveling will certainly give you hope about the human animal, because no matter what the bad things in the world, you will always find that by far the majority of people will try and do the right thing, the kind thing, the generous thing. In my travels, I relied on the kindness of strangers very, very often. And you will always see the same elements played out that are common to the human animal, no matter what their circumstance in the world. And so that's the reason we don't fall out of love with the human species, is because most of us, most of the time, clumsily and badly and awkwardly, will try and love each other and try and do more good than bad. And so in world building, it's completely natural for me to see a snapshot of a group of humans doing the same thing, although very differently from a roadside hovel selling food to a city that's half radioactive still or destroyed. The same human behaviors operate in those places and in those people.
Yeah, I see, and I see that come through in the book. I think of I love that interaction. I don't want to give too much away because I really do encourage people to read the book. But I love that there's a particular interaction that begins as like, all right, you're our hostages now, and very, very quickly becomes something wholly other than that. And does shine a light on this this aspect of actually, even when we're trying to act tough, that there is still a propensity within us to want to help each other. And it was, you know, that was a theme that even came up just this past weekend at Flights of Foundry, where there, I was listening to a panel on utopia and optimism in science fiction, and this like trend, you know, a lot of people talking about like, oh, well, this pattern, this trend of very pessimistic speculations about the future. It's certainly an easy way to maximize conflict. You know, you set this things in a world that's everybody's out to get each other. I think of, you know, even just why I ended up not being able to continue watching The Walking Dead. Because eventually, it just got too nihilistic for me, and it just got too much to the point where, like, really, is really every single human being still alive a monster? I don't believe that. I don't believe that because I've seen the footage of what happens when hurricanes hit. You know, like when earthquakes hit. When 9/11 happened, like I've seen that footage. I've seen what happens even in our own community, you know, when tragedy strikes. And someone else was pointing basically that out at this discussion, and that it's like there's something inauthentic in a way about science fiction that presents that kind of portrait of humanity. And out of that, like we got into this discussion of do we try to make more positive science fiction, and even as an act of resistance, make positive science fiction. So I proposed in the chat that we start a subgenre called optipunk for optimistic sci-fi, defiantly optimistic sci-fi. And I think I think The Last Circus might well fit into optipunk. It might be a good first candidate to hold up as like, hey, here's a good example to follow. It's not all roses and it's not utopia, far from it, but very much, I think, even like you know, Tolkien talked about how Lord of the Rings is centrally about hope. And yet, like, it progressively gets tougher and darker and tougher and darker. But there's a level of which it is testing the limits of hope in its own way. And I felt like The Last Circus did that as well. What kind of reactions have you gotten from people who have been checking out the book so far?
Well, it's interesting. There's been no marketing, so my book has sold in spectacularly low numbers. I'm prepared to spend the entire profits so far on a single bottle of very good whiskey. But the reactions have been interesting because they've been different.
Right.
Different people read the same book and come away with different impressions. It also depends on what you go into the book expecting. If you go in with no expectations at all, I think you get the best responses.
Right.
That's my point. But look, I've got almost all five-star reviews so far on Goodreads, Booktopia, and Amazon. So I'm pleased. I like that people don't just see, you know, they see warmth. Mm-hmm. They love Blanco.
Yes.
They love the character. They love the relationship with Sparrow.
Yeah.
And that's really nice. I think if you're a nerd like us,
yep.
you're going to go in and you're going to look at, okay, show me your ideas. and they're there for the nerds.
Right.
Because that's how we operate. But the most important thing for me was to go on an adventure. Mm-hmm. Because in an adventure, you're called on to react in the moment. And that defines character, as we know as storytellers.
Right.
Your character is revealed in those crucial moments. Do you choose this or this? And that's why I think you get fed up with Walking Dead and the superficiality of this dystopian future that so many writers, whether they be screenwriters or novelists, portray. It just isn't going to be like that. No. You hit the nail on the head. Two planes hit the Twin Towers and people ran towards it rescue people.
Right.
Okay. So when you talk about this bleak dystopian future, I'm going, nah, it's not that simple. People are more interesting than that. We're better than that. I like that readers were entertained by the adventure and were generally surprised by, well, I expected this, but I got that, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's nice. I hope a few more readers enjoy the ride.
I hope so too. Certainly if I can encourage every single person listening to this episode, do check it out. It is certainly one of my favorite things I have read in recent years, and I do read a lot. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I really do think it stands up there with many the great works of science fiction. And it pains me to think like, not enough people have read it. But I feel your pain too, because I'm, very much in the same boat of, I've got a couple books out and whatever, but no marketing budget. And it only gets you so far unless you're a guru at like playing the algorithm game on Twitter or Instagram or whatever. But if word of mouth means anything, I certainly hope go buy the book. I certainly hope people will do it because it's so worthwhile. It's such a wonderful ride that I know I'm going to revisit it. I'm going to want to come back and go through it again and experience it again because there's enough there, as you said, both in terms of ideas, but also the journey of the characters, that it's worth a revisit. And that is a sign of really worthwhile, lasting literature. Certainly, as C.S. Lewis would put it, in his book, Experiment of Criticism, he talks about that idea that, like, really the rereadable stuff, the stuff that you want to come back to, that's a marker of really great literature that's worth revisiting. And certainly this book is not just a really cool science fiction idea, but just even the writing itself, I think, is just really beautiful and well executed and highly worth reading as just a beautiful work of literature. And I think sometimes people forget that there's really beautiful literature happening in the speculative fiction realm.
Yes.
So please check it out.
Yeah, I'll just say I'm reading more diverse works in this area, and there are some really great writers emerging. Great ideas, especially in the short story realm as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So are you, do you have something else in the works? What are you doing these days?
Okay. Well, I've been lucky enough to win two mentorships for two different historical novels. I'm writing about the Pacific War. They're not war novels. They're coming-of-age stories, if you will, set around the Pacific, during the Pacific War. One is set in northern Hokkaido, one is set in East Timor, and one is set in Hawaii and California. And those completely separate stories are going to be adventures and look at the nature of war, how we get into it, how we endure it, and how we get the hell out of it. I'm also revisiting my first manuscript.
Nice.
Which I had to enter into a competition, which is, yeah, it's called Strange Water, and it's a lot of fun. Like I said, the rule of thumb, make everything worse until the end.
Yep.
And there's a dog.
And there's a dog. Perfect. I'm sold.
Yeah. I'm going to continue writing my television scripts. That's my bread and butter work. And I'm going to look at trying to find time to write some film scripts too.
Excellent. That's wonderful. That's quite a bit on that plate. So that's awesome. What kind of TV scripts are you writing these days?
Medical drama. I just sent one off last night. Very soapy, very, commercial breaks, love triangles, cliffhangers, all that stuff.
Right.
The play that I co-wrote with someone, a local writer, that's happening in Hobart in a couple of nights. That was a grant that was offered to collaborate. So we collaborated, had some fun, and came up with a story. Again, set in the near future, actually, when Tasmania, which is a small, relatively rural and unpopulated island, becomes flooded with climate change escapees because it's a cool island. So we did a play about the near future again and the changes that are ahead and what makes us human.
That's awesome. Is that play being produced anywhere?
A small theatre company down in Hobart is going to put it on, more in a reading sense. So there's going to be an invited audience, mm-hmm. A paid audience, and the premise is going to be very simple because it's if you thought of it as a short film, which is your forte, one of your skills, it's going to be basically single frame for the whole thing with the front seat of a taxi and the back seat of a taxi behind it, as the driver, Wendy Chen, who is a refugee from mainland China, drives an illegal taxi and picks up one passenger after another, and some of them come back time and time again, and their stories get told through a single day.
That sounds amazing.
So we had fun with that. Hopefully the actors will enjoy the heck out of it, and we'll all have a bit of a laugh. So
that's awesome. Well, hopefully I don't know if there's plans for ability to publish that play. It sounds fantastic. I'd love to read that.
I must read it again before I go.
Right. But that sounds just really, that's awesome. That sounds like you're doing really great work. Where can people catch up with you? They can kind of keep up with what you're doing and check out some of your work.
I do have a website, which is I've actually been blogging recently. You might be interested, Michael, yeah. to have a little look at, especially the last three posts I did, because they talk about some of the things that we haven't talked about, like AI and transhumanism, right. singularities, mm-hmm. stuff like that. So it's one word, Ben Marshall Writer.
Ben Marshall
Writer. BenMarshallWriter.com. And so, yeah, people are welcome to hit me up there. I enjoy discussion, obviously. Otherwise, yeah, I'm a reclusive person living with my wife and our dogs and about a few hundred marsupials. You can't see out the window, but I've got a mountain just up there and I've got a little range just behind us out here, and we've got rainforest, cool rainforest all around us. It was -4 this morning. It was pretty damn cool. So all the baby kangaroos and things that we get here, they're all out in the sun now, warming themselves after a very cold night.
Sure.
Poor little buggers.
Oh, that sounds amazing. That's great. But yeah, I will definitely have to catch up on those blogs. That does sound really, really fascinating. So we'll check those out. And I believe there's links on there as well for The Last Circus on Earth. And do you have any other books out as well?
No. The publishing game, as you know, mm-hmm. Especially if you want to be traditionally published, makes climbing Mount Everest look like a pretty straightforward endeavor.
It does.
So at the moment, one book only, but I'm really hoping for another. That's the goal, but it's sheer madness. I don't recommend anybody follow this path unless they have a very wealthy partner or a trust fund, or they just like being really poor.
Or you're willing to do it on nights and weekends, I guess, you know. It's what I'm doing these days, you know, nights and weekends. Or mornings and weekends. It's more like it sometimes.
Well, you're doing some really interesting work too, and I'm looking forward to having a look at the Foundry YouTube videos that you – I saw one posted this morning. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing them.
Yeah, they're really wonderful discussions. It was really great to be part of it. I certainly learned a lot. And I even just learned about a new platform, Discord, which I was not familiar with, which is what they used for chatting. So I was still able to meet people, you know, and actually interact with people that route, which is pretty unique. It felt very apropos for a speculative fiction event to be happening in the most sci-fi way possible. You know, this is one of these moments that I feel like I have very regularly now, which is like, holy shit, I'm living in the future. You know, like you remember, like, oh, all this crazy connectivity that we take for granted, you know, taken for granted that, you know, for my day job, I often am communicating with folks in Australia, and now I'm gonna, you know, do it again and communicate with someone in Tasmania, you know, like, so it's these things that I think it goes along back to that idea of like, we as human beings, we're actually capable of more than we give ourselves credit for, because we so quickly get used to things. But if we stop and remember and appreciate what we're managing to pull off, even in the middle of all this craziness, it's pretty remarkable. But all that to say, I do think, check out Flights of Foundry. It was highly worthwhile, and I certainly plan on being back next year as well, and trying to participate in whatever capacity I can, whether it's virtual or maybe there'll be some ability to be in person again or something. So, but yeah. But Ben, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to chat and discuss your writing and your book. And thank you for writing this book. It's just really, really enjoyable. And so thank you for commenting on my episodes of this podcast and so that I'd discover so I'd find out about you, because I've really enjoyed reading the book and enjoy getting to chat with you for a while.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for doing this, and hopefully we'll have to maybe do this again. I'll check out those blog entries, and who knows, maybe we'll have more conversations here in the future.
That'll be lovely.
Excellent. Well, Ben, thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Ciao.
In the next episode of Exploring Tomorrow, I am going to be talking with SB Divya about her brand new novel, Machinehood. So be sure to hit subscribe so you can know when that episode drops, coming up next week. All right, folks, that's what I have for you this episode. I hope you really enjoyed it. I had an absolute blast getting to talk with Ben Marshall and to just pick his brain a little bit about his book, The Last Circus on Earth. I'm going to grab a copy here real quick. This is the book, and as I clearly have indicated throughout this episode, I loved it. It is honestly, it's a masterpiece. I'll say it. It is. It really just is breathtaking in so many ways. And from the writing to the scope of the story, to the characters and the deep emotion and the world building, all of those things are done at such a beautiful level that I really do encourage you, check it out. Highly worthwhile book. I could not put it down and really just truly enjoyed it right to the last page. And like I said, it's one I'm probably going to have to revisit because, man, it was good. So check it out. And as Ben said, benmarshallwriter.com is his website. Encourage you to go take a look there. I'm going to be hopping on and reading some of those blog entries he mentioned and be keeping up with what he's doing. And if you know of anyone else who might enjoy this type of story, please send them over to check out The Last Circus on Earth. And if you want to check out any of my stuff, again, that's michaelwhistler.com. And very much like Ben, I don't really have any sort of marketing budget or anything, so I hugely appreciate it. If you want to stop by my website, check out my blog, check out any of my short stories or books, it means the world to me when you do that. And of course, what also means the world to me is if you comment on this or rate this podcast on your podcasting service, wherever you happen to be listening to this, give it a thumbs up, a 5-star rating if you think it deserves that. And leave feedback. Let me know, like, what do you want to hear about next? All of those things really help me build a better show. It helps boost the visibility of the show. Really just means a lot to me to be able to know that folks are connecting with these themes and these ideas as we think about how do we build a better world and how we might be able to use speculative fiction to do that. So thank you for coming along on this journey, and please continue to be safe out there. Take care of each other and recommend good books to each other, and keep asking the big questions, wondering why, and speculating about the future. All right, folks, we'll talk to you soon. We'll see you later.